Hank. I'd give up anything I've ever had in my life except my being a luxury object of your amusement. He saw her hand trembling as she held her glass. He said evenly, I know it, dearest. She sat shocked and still. He had never used that word before. He threw his head back and smiled the most brilliantly gay smile she had ever seen on his face. Your first moment of weakness, Dagny, he said. She laughed and shook her head. He stretched his arm across the table and closed his hand over her naked shoulder, as if giving her an instant's support. Laughing softly, and as if by accident, she let her mouth brush against his fingers. It kept her face down for the one moment when he could have seen the brilliance of her eyes was tears. When she looked up at him, her smile matched his, and the rest of the evening was their celebration for all his years since the nights on the mine ledges, for all her years since the night of her first ball when, in desolate longing for an uncaptured vision of gaiety, she had wondered about the people who expected the lights and the flowers to make them brilliant. Isn't there, in what we're taught, some error that's vicious and very important? She thought of his words as she lay in an armchair of her living room on a dismal evening of spring, waiting for him to come. Just a little farther, my darling, she thought. Look a little farther, and you'll be free of that error, and of all the wasted pain you never should have had to carry. But she felt that she, too, had not seen the whole of the distance, and she wondered what were the steps left for her to discover. Walking through the darkness of the streets on his way to her apartment, Reardon kept his hands in his coat pockets and his arms pressed to his sides, because he felt that he did not want to touch anything or brush against anyone. He had never experienced it before. The sense of revulsion that was not aroused by any particular object, but seemed to flood everything around him, making the city seem sodden. He could understand disgust for any one thing, and he could fight that thing with the healthy indignation of knowing that it did not belong in the world. But this was new to him. This feeling that the world was a loathsome place where he did not want to belong. He had held a conference with the producers of Copper, who had just been garroted by a set of directives that would put them out of existence in another year. He had had no advice to give them, no solution to offer. His ingenuity, which had made him famous as the man who would always find a way to keep production going, had not been able to discover a way to save them. But they had all known that there was no way. Ingenuity was a virtue of the mind, and in the issue confronting them, the mind had been discarded as irrelevant long ago. It's a deal between the boys in Washington and the importers of copper, one of the men had said. Mainly Dunconia copper. This was only a small, extraneous stab of pain, he thought, a feeling of disappointment in an expectation he had never had the right to expect. He should have known that this was just what a man like Francisco Dunconia would do, and he wondered angrily why he felt as if a bright, brief flame had died somewhere in a lightless world. He did not know whether the impossibility of acting had given him this sense of loathing, or whether the loathing had made him lose the desire to act. It's both, he thought. A desire presupposes the possibility of action to achieve it. Action presupposes a goal which is worth achieving. If the only goal possible was to wheedle a precarious moment's favor from men who held guns, then neither action nor desire could exist any longer. Then could life? He asked himself indifferently. Life, he thought, had been defined as motion. Man's life was purposeful motion. What was the state of a being to whom purpose and motion were denied? A being held in chains, but left to breathe and to see all the magnificence of the possibilities he could have reached. Left to scream, why? And to be shown the muzzle of a gun as sole explanation. He shrugged, walking on. He did not care even to find an answer. He observed indifferently the devastation wrought by his own indifference. No matter how hard a struggle he had lived through in the past, he had never reached the ultimate ugliness of abandoning the will to act. In moments of suffering, he had never let pain win its one permanent victory. He had never allowed it to make him lose the desire for joy. He had never doubted the nature of the world or man's greatness as its motive power and its core. Years ago he had wondered with contemptuous incredulity about the fanatical sects that appeared among men in the dark corners of history. The sects who believed that man was trapped in a malevolent universe ruled by evil for the sole purpose of his torture. Tonight he knew what their vision of the world and their feel of it had been. If what he now saw around him was the world in which he lived, then he did not want to touch any part of it. He did not want to fight it. He was an outsider, with nothing at stake and no concern for remaining alive much longer. Dagny and his wish to see her were the only exception left to him. The wish remained. But in a sudden shock, he realized that he felt no desire to sleep with her tonight. That desire, which had never given him a moment's rest, which had been growing, feeding on its own satisfaction, was wiped out. It was an odd impotence, neither of his mind nor of his body. He felt as passionately as he had ever felt it, that she was the most desirable woman on earth. But what came from it was only a desire to desire her, a wish to feel, not a feeling. The sense of numbness seemed impersonal, as if its root were neither in him nor in her, as if it were the act of sex that now belonged to a realm which he had left. "Don't get up. Stay there. It's so obvious that you've been waiting for me that I want to look at it longer." He said it from the doorway of her apartment, seeing her stretched in an armchair, seeing the eager little jolt that threw her shoulders forward as she was about to rise. He was smiling. He noted, as if some part of him were watching his reactions with detached curiosity, that his smile and his sudden sense of gaiety were real. He grasped a feeling that he had always experienced, but never identified because it had always been absolute and immediate, a feeling that forbade him ever to face her in pain. It was much more than the pride of wishing to conceal his suffering. It was the feeling that suffering must not be granted recognition in her presence, that no form of claim between them should ever be motivated by pain and aimed at pity. It was not pity that he brought here or came here to find. "Do you still need proof that I'm always waiting for you?" she asked, leaning obediently back in her chair. Her voice was neither tender nor pleading, but bright and mocking. "Dagny, why is it that most women would never admit that? But you do. Because they're never sure that they ought to be wanted. I am. I do admire self-confidence." "Self-confidence was only one part of what I said, Hank." "What's the whole?" "Confidence of my value and yours." He glanced at her as if catching the spark of a sudden thought, and she laughed, adding, "I wouldn't be sure of holding a man like Orrin Boyle, for instance. He wouldn't want me at all." "You would." "Are you saying," he asked slowly, "that I rose in your estimation when you found that I wanted you?" "Of course. That's not the reaction of most people of being wanted." "It isn't. Most people feel that they rise in their own eyes if others want them. I feel that others live up to me if they want me. And that is the way you feel too, Hank, about yourself, whether you admit it or not." "That's not what I said to you then on that first morning," he thought, looking down at her. She lay stretched out lazily, her face blank, but her eyes bright with amusement. He knew that she was thinking of it, and that she knew he was. He smiled, but said nothing else. As he sat half-stretched on the couch, watching her across the room, he felt at peace, as if some temporary wall had risen between him and the things he had felt on his way here. He told her about his encounter with the man from the State Science Institute, because even though he knew that the event held danger, an odd, glowing sense of satisfaction still remained from it in his mind. He chuckled at her look of indignation. "Don't bother being angry at them," he said. "It's no worse than all the rest of what they're doing every day." "Hank, do you want me to speak to Dr. Stadler about it?"
"Certainly not."
"He ought to stop it. He could at least do that much."
"I'd rather go to jail."
"Dr. Stadler?"
"You're not having anything to do with him, are you?"
"I saw him a few days ago."
"Why?"
"In regard to the motor."
The motor. He said it slowly, in a strange way, as if the thought of the motor had suddenly brought back to him a reality he had forgotten.